Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, Nicks? What the fuck, buddies? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. I'm going to talk to Benedict Cumberbatch today, okay? You know him from Sherlock, the Marvel movies where he plays Doctor Strange, the Imitation Game, and you know, movies, more. He's been in a lot of stuff. He's got two movies you can see right now. The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne is streaming on Prime Video, and the other one is Jane Campion's The Power of the Dog, which is now in theaters and streaming on Netflix. Both very good. I watched both of them. If you haven't watched The Power of the Dog yet, here's a heads up. We had a good long talk about the movie, okay, and we didn't hold back. So if you want to watch the movie first before listening to that part of our conversation, I'll jump in and I'll give you a warning when it's about to happen, because that's the kind of guy I am, all right? I didn't want to remove the conversation. It was too good. So I'm going to let you know that spoilers are about to happen, and you can make your choice. I'm giving you that choice. So I think I'm landing in a sort of, I don't know, is it loneliness? I don't know. I don't know what this grief tunnel is like. I don't know how to frame my life anymore. I know that every day feels like a week, and that, you know, by the time I go to bed, I feel like I've the morning was, I can't even remember when it started. And it's not bad. I don't mind that time is longer than it seems or it is, because I know it's all going to crunch at the end and run out, but I guess I'm kind of beginning the dark floundering of what it means to be me at this point in time at 58 years old, having been through what I've been through. What do I need for myself? What do I need from other people? I don't like having to answer these questions, but the life that I've chosen has put me here. I've foregone any sort of sense of security or status quo. I've tried and failed at many relationships. I've had someone I love pass away. I've fought and lost with many people, places, things, institutions, but I have my success and I have, you know, my voice and I'm doing good work, but it's like, what does it mean? You know, when you wake up with the darkness, with the heaviness, as Rodney called it, I got the heaviness is on me, but I don't have chemical heaviness. It's just sort of like, you know, what am I going to do with this tired old heart? Huh? Answer me that. What am I going to do with this tired old heart? I've still got juice. I still got energy. I can carry this heart over the finish line. It's just that maybe I can lighten the load or add something to it, or I don't know, man. Now, am I sad? I'm not. I'm not sad. Look, don't get me wrong. I've been, you know, I've got friends. You know, there's people I lean on, a couple, not many. Everything's fine. Don't be concerned. I think this was all triggered in some weird way by that Beatles documentary. I can't explain it. I can't explain it, but it's like, I feel, look, I don't know, am I a Beatles fanatic? No, when I was younger, did I listen? Of course. I had a friend, my friend Dean Hines, in junior high, had all the Beatles records. My parents had that Let It Be record. I listened to that Let It Be record. I was 5, 6, 7 years old. They're infused into you genetically. If you get it, you get it. Most people get it. Of course, there are those people that are like, no, I never really saw it in the Beatles. Like, okay, that's kind of sad more than anything else. Whatever position you're taking against the Beatles, it's just sort of, all right, well, it's too bad. You missed out on some uplifting shit there, some soul nourishment. And I just don't get it. I love that position. Now that this like 90-hour documentary comes out, there's all these Beatle detractors, you know, like, no, 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 I didn't get it. You know, like, who gives a fuck whether you got it or not? Look, I'm no fanatic, but it's in my soul. It's in my blood cells. I don't know why. It is. I spent like days and days drawing a picture of John Lennon's face that won me an award in the art contest in high school. It was good. I wish I knew what happened to that thing. Very proud of it. I nailed it. John spoke through me. But something about watching them, you know, it's like I've known them all my life. You know? I've known them all my life, and I knew exactly what to expect, but this was the first time I ever got to hang out with them, and it feels like that. They're just hanging out writing songs, and they're really like old-timey rock and roll guys, but I don't know, it's almost like you're just in the room hanging out too, and I don't find that there are any real surprises for me. I'm like, yep, this is the way it is. This is who these guys are. And it just ingrains in you. It was like filling this tremendous gap in your soul and in your cells, if your cells are filled with Beatles, which mine are, and a lot of people's are. So like, I you know, there were parts of it that were boring, that were annoying, but whatever. And I'm not even finished with the fucking thing. But there was a familiarity to it. Like, it's like, I always knew these guys. I always knew them. I always knew the Beatles. And I didn't take into consideration any of the tension or anything else. I'm just sort of like, oh, finally, we're fucking hanging out. And yeah, it's cool to see songs evolve, and it's interesting to see how they work. But it was almost filling in a piece of myself that I've been waiting for. The humanization of the heroes continues. Is it good? I don't know, man. We always knew they were mortals because one was gunned down. One died of cancer. And I'm not of that generation. These were hand-me-down myths. I'm not sure what was going on when I was supposed to be taking shit in. I got the shit handed down, hand-me-downs from the late 60s and 70s. You know, what was going on with me with new wave, disco, then punk, which I missed. I'm infused with classic rock that I had to push back against at some point and integrate some Eno and some Bowie and some Fred Frith and some Residents and, you know, then in college, you know, the other stuff. But I was wired post-60s with hand-me-downs, one of which was the Eternal Beatles. How did they take over the world? I don't know. But all I know is watching it and feeling these guys as human was as elating as it was sad. You know, not because two of them are dead or they're all old or it was another time, but really because they're just humans. And when these heroes or mythic people become human, your heart sort of like sighs a little bit. I think it sighs. You're like, oh, that's nice, but oh, where's the bigger than life stuff, man? What if you don't have a God in place? What if you're just, your heart's just a skipping stone on some sort of pool of art and stuff that makes you feel better, stuff that moves you? What if that's it? Maybe I got to pay attention to the pool, man. Let's chase these metaphors. Let's chase them down and fuck them. These metaphors. Huh? Chase it down. My heart is a skipping stone on the pool of art and stuff that moves me. I gotta let it drop in, man. See that? That's chasing it down. Fuck. I don't know, man. The Beatles made me sad as much as it made me excited. You know, and then like, what am I grounded in? What am I grounded in? I'm grounded in insanely deep self-consciousness around slightly real fat. The gift from the holidays and from my mother. Anyway, Benedict Cumberbatch is in The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne. That's streaming on Prime Video. Very good. It's a very exciting movie. The Power of the Dog is now playing in theaters and streaming on Netflix. And again, there's some stuff in this talk that really gets into The Power of the Dog. There was really no way to avoid talking about some of the big reveals of the movie. If you want to avoid that part, I'll warn you when it's about to happen. Okay? All right, this is me talking to Benedict Cumberbatch. I did it at my old house.
You did?
That's where it started.
That's where it began.
Yeah.
So did Obama come to the house?
Yes.
All of them have been in the house.
In the old house, yeah.
That's so cool.
Same chair.
It's cool. From one great ass to another.
Yes. Do you want to wear cans?
I do, actually, yes. It feels more intimate. It feels like I know what
it's
we're...
It's better, yeah.
...sounding like together.
And you can pull it. That mic up into your face.
Ooh,
that's great.
Technique. I love it.
You know it.
Yeah.
You know how to do it.
I do some voice work.
You do a lot of voice work.
I do, yeah.
You're like the main guy.
I'm Mr. Voice.
You're the main guy of all of the things. How long have you been in L.A. for?
I've been here for last Monday.
Oh, so all for the promotion of both things?
And work, and we're doing.
You're working too.
Strange, yeah. I pick up that tomorrow. Having talked about
Doctor Strange, the Marvel thing,
the dog, yeah.
And this is this the fourth movie where you're
him? This is the I can't remember how many I've been in now. That's a bit forgetful. I this is the second one of him on his own.
So this is your movie.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, that's part of the problem. There's a lot of stuff going on in it. It's like, well, I do have a character arc in this. Is it working?
You know? Yeah, right.
No, there's great stuff for me to do in it. It's very busy.
So
it's called The Multiverse of Madness, and it's bonkers.
Oh, okay. I'm not a guy that watches those.
No, fine.
Good. I've read the comic books, and I believe that you can do it.
Oh, good.
I've read some Doctor Strange from back in the day. I'm not a big comic book nerd, but I liked him.
Yeah.
He seemed like one of the ones that I could relate to.
Yeah, he's quite kind of... he's out there.
What's his angle? How did it happen? And why does he have whatever he has?
He had a car crash.
And
he was a brain surgeon.
He
used his hands and went looking for physical healing and found something much more profound.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
So you're shooting that here, the studio thing?
We are this leg of it. We did the body of it last year during lockdown in England, which was fun. We just come back here for reshoots. It's what Marvel do.
Reshoots in that, so you do them at a soundstage kind of deal?
Yeah. They got the Manhattan Beach Studios. That's the kind of Marvel.
Oh yeah, and what's the studio?
It's Marvel. It's Disney, but it's at
Disney.
Manhattan Beach. Yeah,
okay.
They've got the lot down there.
You're so fucking busy.
A little bit.
Those are classic kind of, they look old, those glasses.
They're nice, aren't they?
Yeah,
they're new, but they're old. I am only wearing them because they're prescription. I don't have some
Yeah, I have that
deal
too.
With the but light,
what,
but
what
I,
brand
I'm
are
sorry
those?
If they're a bit dark.
No, I don't care.
I can give you my truth by doing that.
It's just okay. If it's necessary. If I require
Benedict,
some truth.
Lower your glasses.
Yes, I want.
I'm not buying your bullshit.
I need truth eyes. Give me the truth eyes.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see you as a human.
Thank you.
Hard for me to adjust, you know, when I see you on camera. Because no one looks like you, and that's not a bad thing.
Great.
But in real life, you look different. You look like, that's just a guy on the street. But in movies, you're like, holy shit, that's that guy. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
I mean, I guess I'll take the compliment, I guess.
It's a compliment.
Yeah. I mean, look, anything that changes it up and also makes me obscure on the street is a good thing.
Yeah, that's good. But that's like some of the questions, and I don't really prepare questions, but first of all, I was doing a little research, and you've never done comedy, though, have you?
Oh, for fuck's sake. Yes, I have. I have done comedy.
Like stand-up for
reals? No, I'm joking about how the shallowness of... not stand-up, no.
I know you've done comedy, but I mean, there's like a little section on the wiki page that says impressionist, and I'm like, was he an impressionist? Or when I say, have you done comedy, I mean like stand-up.
Like your rightful title of being a comedian or comedian. No. And my friends who had the balls to do it just reminded me how... little I wanted to do it.
Who are your
friends? They're really good at it. There were two. There were two at university who became a double act: Matt Horn and Bruce McKinnon. And Matt went on to work a lot with James Corden. They did a series together, and that's what he's known. And Bruce is a great actor. But you know, I was just blown away. Not only by and that wasn't solo stuff. And then I started seeing their friends doing solo mic stuff and getting to know them. And it confounds me.
Wasn't for you?
who knows? I take lots of leaps of faith in my work. I love putting myself under a sort of different pressure and having to interrogate something that I've never experienced before and taking a risk. But that is one I haven't done yet. I also haven't done a musical or a horror.
Musicals.
So I could do all three in one, maybe. Just
What was the third one?
Horror, musical, and stand-up.
No horror?
No horror. Not really.
I feel like you've gotten close.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, the sort of psychological darkness of the film, we're here to talk about The Power of the Dog, and also obviously Strange in the next film and stuff. There's horror elements and stuff I've done for sure.
But what's this impressionist thing?
I don't know, just sounding like people.
But like there's one on there.
Yeah.
And who I've talked about recently.
Who?
Malkovich.
John. Yeah. Oh, John Malkovich, I can't. It's interesting. I haven't heard him for a long time, so I'd probably be better at doing you right now than I would be doing John.
Right, you got to be right in it, right?
Yeah, kind of. I've got to hear it. We were in an animation together, and he was playing like this evil octopus. He was so good.
That must
really
have been good.
It was, because his wonderful singularity and eccentricity
that's
was
right.
just, you know, it's like Christopher Walken's ignoring of grammar. It's
I think that's true.
You know,
right, that they're similar.
I can do this. You know, it's just, it, and I love it. I love it. It sounds like new minted thought because the form is so odd at what you suppose it to be when you read it off the page and it grabs you by the balls. You're in. You're kind of listening to something. It's a new music.
Right. But you are more of a transformative. It seems, because that's where I was
rather
going.
Than having a kind of trademark style like those guys, I suppose I am, although they've also, you know, I mean, what is transformation? I think if you're in a story and you're watching, whether it's Malkovich or me or whatever, and you're engaged, it is a transformation. And I think people, by the way, who play variations of themselves, who are close to themselves in physicality or sound, I still believe the storytelling. Do you know what I mean?
No, of course. Like, I don't begrudge them that, because I think, like, even Clooney's a guy that, like, can't, you know, he's not going to un-Clooney himself.
Yeah, but do you remember the leap into the unknown? I mean, I thought the Coen Brothers movie. I mean, he was just that was a complete release.
Oh, sure, he's playing the guy with the hair goop. And
I love watching him.
No, he's great. He's great, but but there's always that sort of fundamental Clooney charm that he's not going to get rid of. Even when he's playing a menacing guy. Even when it's Michael Clayton, you're sort of like, nah, it's George Clooney there. But it's not bad. He's a great actor. But my question is, like, even watching this, the Lewis Wayne movie, what is the Fantastic Lewis Wayne? Is that what it's called?
The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne.
The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne. I didn't know about that guy.
Me neither.
Oh, wow. And then I watched the Jane Campion movie, Power of the Dog.
Yeah.
Now, these are distinctly different, and it just seems that, you know, I don't know what you do. I've done a little acting myself, but it seems that when you're doing someone like Louis Wayne, I mean, how do you construct it?
I think we wanted to tell the story of a human being. So you look a little bit at the history, but it wasn't supposed to be a dry biopic by any degree. It was supposed to be a very singular experience of his world through his eye. And
it's
so
great.
Thank you. And I kind of just dove in with the script and with Will. I there was a little bit of anecdotal evidence as to what he was like, how he held himself, how he spoke, a sort of monotone of excitement where he could be saying, I really love your shoelaces. And by the way, that mountain's about to slide on your head. You know, that comes with its own sort of interesting diversions from what we see as the norm, I guess.
Yeah.
But it took a while, and the physicality was something that evolves in the picture as well, because obviously it is a life and he's aging, but there's a sort of electricity in him and an energy in him which was there both in his youth and I wanted to have in his old age as well. There's a scene where he's dancing as an old man to reference the dance of falling in love with Emily at the beginning of the film, played by the brilliant Claire Foy. And I saw that he was improvisational. He did things in a very eclectic, different way.
Right.
There was something charged about how he would do things. He'd set the room alight, and this is again anecdotal. Like, he was a great firebrand and charge of energy in a party, and people would sort of gather around him like a breakdancer and like give him the energy to just kind of do this spasmodic crazed dance.
Yeah, right. Get the weirdo going.
Yeah,
yeah.
Just get funky.
Yeah,
just lose
yeah.
yourself. Don't be restricted. In the Victorian era, I mean, that guy, what kind of a wonderful comic.
Yeah. So it came through kind of like a process of looking at the script, understanding the idiosyncrasies that were documented.
And then seeing what I needed to kind of get a grasp in it. So asking help with dialect, asking help with or speech pattern delivery, that kind of thing. And also talking
Who
to
are you asking
and working
help to?
with a
dialect coach?
Yeah.
Was it a different dialect than you would have?
No, but it was just about delivery. It was just about having a look at it, you know, just playing around with form. And then the other thing I was going to mention was the choreographer, just to work with somebody who is about putting the physical body in the space and telling the story through his body language and what his emotional tells were when the walls started to come in, because they did with him. He suffered mental health issues and certain moments in a very pressured situation, looking after six sisters, dealing with death, dealing with debt and a Victorian era of replication of his work illegally. You know, all this stuff would make a sane guy crazy.
Yeah, lose it.
And he already was, he had a, you know, a tentative grasp on reality as it was. So it's a horrible, torturous, lonely place to be. But how that would compound in his body and the way he interacted with things outside of his way of seeing the world, and those slides into chaos and real terror. That was something to put in the body, as well as doing the kind of deeper work as to what was going on in his mind and what it felt like to be him.
And also his emotions that, you know, there was that pivotal moment in there at the end when he's an old man and the doctor, you know, tells him how to interpret the electricity.
That it's love.
Yeah.
It's always been love.
Right.
And it is a love story. I mean, it's riddled with tragedy and, it's humor and dark comedy.
Yeah, it's really kind of an amazing balance for a film to have the kind of darkness that's in that thing, yet still sort of, you know, it's still beautiful.
That's Will Sharp. I mean, he did an amazing job on a series called Flowers. I don't know if you saw on Channel 4. Olivia Colman's in it, and Julia Bauer is one half of The Mighty Bush, which you might know. It was a comedy duo. Yeah. Him and Noel Fielding. Yeah, amazing, amazing pair. In fact, Noel was one of the guys I saw do stand up, and I thought, yeah, I can never do that.
Oh, really?
Just amazing, extraordinary. Anyway, but you know, he deals in that with profound issues of depression and self doubt and suicidal thought, and
in the Flowers.
Yeah, and yet it's incredibly funny, incredibly moving, and textured and layered and detailed. Huh. And he was our guy the minute he came in and pitched the film. As he saw it and the changes he wanted to make to Simon Stevens' great script, we were like, we're in, because you're wanting to turn this into a singular experience for an audience through as much of Louis Wayne's work.
Yeah, also like the sort of foundation of a sort of psychedelic vision because of his misunderstanding of, or maybe not, of electricity.
Yeah.
But also like, but that pivot, that weird moment at the end where it's love and it seems to make sense to Louis.
Yeah.
Is kind of beautiful, but like leading up to that, so you got to see that whole script before you started.
Sure.
So, you know, all that, you know, holding that thing in, because he doesn't understand it.
He doesn't understand it. To be in that place, it's stressful, actually.
And to feel love without being able to sort of completely realize it.
I know. And also when he has it, when it's held, when he has space with it, with Emily, for that to be cut so tragically short. I mean, there were very, very easy springboards for me to sort of get into a place where I felt a connection to the guy's suffering, for sure. Like when he has that breakdown coming back on the transatlantic ship.
Oh, yeah. I was concerned. Because I don't know enough about the guy. I'm like, did he die? He didn't die like that. He didn't die in a shipwreck. Did he?
I know. But I mean, and it sort of tied in with this idea of her recurring nightmare. He really kind of didn't know himself as a feverish child who had these sort of really awful dreams that then broke, he thought, in scarlet fever, he said himself, and then I felt normal again. And then he clearly carried that for a lot of his life. And so for that to come back in Will's narrative at the point where he doesn't find success in America, everything is alien to him and he can't find his place in the world. And just the noise is so dialed up that he just collapses. It didn't have to go far to understand it. And it's horrible.
Yeah, and also like, you know, knowing now what we know about that particular type of mental illness.
Completely, and how he could have been saved or hopefully seen.
Or at least understood.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Completely, completely.
But like I didn't know anything about that guy. I did a movie with Andrea Riseborough.
What did you do with her?
It's not out yet.
Oh, great. Okay,
well, like, I play her, like, it's called To Leslie. It's a movie that we shot in the middle of COVID.
Oh, wow.
We shot it in 19 days. Wow. She was probably on it longer. It was shot on film by a guy named Mike Morris, who's, I think, British, and he does a lot of Better Call Saul's in his first movie.
Oh, wow.
And it's just, she plays a Texan. I play a Texan. Like,
she's so fierce, isn't she? She's just so good.
I don't know what to do with her. Like, you know, you watch her, like, holy shit. But this part for her is such a beautiful kind of like, you know, kind of a classic, you know, Victorian aggravated spinster.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's trying to be the adult in the room where everything is just so fucking chaotic because Libby can't do it. And he marries the governess who in real life, not that, you know, Claire Foy looks anything but 10 years younger than me.
Yeah.
But she was 10 years older. So those are both sort of exilable kind of conditions. So they lived in exile. They were literally exiled from the family and from Victorian society as the odd couple who lived near Hampstead Heath back in the day when that was an exile from London. And that's when they adopted the cat. And it was because Andrea's character is the matriarch, really, with a mother who's a little bit ill and out of it, just couldn't bear the shame. She couldn't bear being the one, the proprietor's kind of authority figure in that family.
And she was, I think, it was, so it's a comic role, really.
It's very comic. I mean, that scene with her and Claire at the door.
It's crazy.
It's a masterclass in sort of the fine line between terrifying and funny.
Yeah. And I didn't realize that cats were so like, you know, people just didn't like them. They were just like for mousing and like the lower class people.
They were one up from the vermin they were trained and bred to catch. And a bag of cats drowning was not a phrase. It was a reality all the fucking time.
Is that her?
Coffee call. Yeah, it might be. Hold on.
So wait, you haven't had coffee lately?
Not much, no. I had COVID and I just kind of cut out anything.
How many, when did you have COVID?
I had it about a month ago.
Really?
Yes, 3 weeks ago is when my sort of isolation ended, yeah.
So you got it late?
I mean, yeah, compared to everyone else that has it or had it, yeah.
Did you, but you hadn't gotten vaccinated yet?
Oh yeah, double vaccines.
And you still got it?
A breakthrough case, although I have to say about the breakthrough thing, I think, you know, vaccines do probably work for 6 months.
Yeah.
And then you should really look at a top.
You only got it once though?
We didn't, I had both, but I'd had my second dose 6 months before I went into a very crowded room.
You only had COVID once?
Yeah. I do know a couple of people who've had it like 3 times.
Really?
Yeah, and all of which not badly. And I'm like, you motherfuckers. Just like,
wow.
You know, the other ones are living free lives and taking all the risks and you'd be very lucky.
I tested myself today.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah.
And yesterday and the day before. Yeah,
well, because you got to shoot. I don't have to shoot. I just have a box of tests.
But, you know, and also we're doing this in a closed room. Right. And like, you know,
well, yeah, and I got to travel tomorrow, but I just got the booster. I'm boosted.
Oh, you're fine.
A week ago. Who the fuck knows?
I had to get my own by getting sick, which I don't recommend. It's much better to get the
jab. How sick did you get?
So, you know, 5 days of pretty nasty kind of fever and headache. Yeah, I wasn't well.
But
the taste and smell thing was so weird, and it's only just now come properly.
Really?
Back. I would get the taste of something at the beginning of it, and then it would just go like a ghost. It was like, oh, what was that? And then, you know, and then when it came back, it was the same thing. It was like, hang on. I think that's an apple. I know it is because I'm eating one, but it didn't last.
It's the worst.
It's really weird.
It's the worst.
Yeah.
So, so let's talk about this cat thing because, like, that's like, because I'm a cat guy.
Yeah.
You know, my friend Kit's a cat person.
Yeah.
And, like, I just did a benefit last night for pit bulls, and it was like, it was difficult for me because they have these big pictures.
Oh, you're so much a cat guy that you're not a dog guy.
No, I grew up with dogs, but, like, I really cannot handle the neediness of dogs. I resent them.
Okay. Like, you're much more sophisticated than me. I'm so needy. I fucking love it when someone else needs me.
Really?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I'm needy, but like you got to go through quite an obstacle course with me. It's like,
it's pretty easy to satisfy a dog's need. I have to be honest, but you know, I find them. I don't know. Claire made a really good comparison. Claire Foy, who plays,
she's Emma great.
In this film, she's just always amazing. She's a dear friend. We worked together before, and we know each other well. And she said in one of our interviews, she went, yeah, I don't know. I like cats. I can admire them, but I don't know if I'd want to live with them. A bit like a supermodel. You're like, you know, you're great, but it's kind of freaking me out.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, you gotta work awfully hard, and you're not even sure you're getting much.
I know. You built a whole.
I built a catio for them.
Catio.
Well, yeah. There's only a couple of frequencies that cats have, but you know they are. When you do get something, it's a lot more exciting.
I guess, because they're pretty wild. They're in a magical sense.
Yeah, yeah. And like dogs, right? They're, you know, they're all out all the time. Like cats, they'll do something like, holy shit.
But amazing. I love whippets who have quite a sort of eccentric. Whippets. Yeah, they have bursts of affection. And then they're like, they're very happy to just curl up by a fire.
But they're so skinny and weird.
But they're very affectionate and lovely. And not, you know, I don't need a dog to be fleshy and airy to love. You know, I can love a skinny dog.
No, I know. I grew up with Old English sheepdogs. We have 4 of them.
That's too hairy.
Too many. Yeah, a lot of hair. A lot of hair. But I didn't realize that Louis Wayne sort of helped popularize the cat as a pet.
Very much.
And are those paintings worth money now? I mean,
Yeah, and I'm, you know, maybe this will bring him back into a focus again. I mean, if you,
because they are sort of
one,
illustrations.
Yeah, you should get one now, Mark. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, really?
Hopefully, if our film does anything, it might raise the value.
Because
he
was what you would call, I think, an outsider artist.
I guess so. Yeah,
as he got later in his life, and because that's a great moment in the hospital where the nurse says, you know, he's insane, and you know, look at what he's doing. It's crazy. Remember the amazing, and it was actually really kind of provocative.
And that was the stuff that was the psychedelic era that then picked him up again in the 60s and 70s.
Oh,
did? Yeah, massively. And you know who's in the film? He's a massive collector and fan of him.
Nick Cave.
Yeah,
he's got that. Is he H.G. Wells? Is that who he's supposed to be?
He's Nick Cave as H.G. Wells. It's one of those sort of things, again, with the biopic of like, you know, it's a very...
Nick loves that guy?
Yeah, he just wanted to do it. And he said, oh, am I doing okay? I just feel like I'm me. And I said, that's kind
fine.
Of what
it's
it
like
needs to be. It's brilliant.
You're in it for 30 seconds. You knock yourself out. don't sweat it too much.
No, just be cool. I love those idiosyncrasies throughout the kind of casting and just... Will's just a great storyteller. He creates a world, and
it was great. It was great. You know, I found it moving. You know, because I had experienced some grief in the last year in a very profound way, in a similar way that he had, and it was. I've been noticing.
It's a hard watch for that.
I'm sorry, a good watch for that.
You've experienced that recently. Okay, that's good to hear.
Because you don't know what the hell to do with that.
Yeah.
No one knows what to do with that.
Yeah.
And it's not really. And there's no real public discourse around it.
No.
And like that guy, even the way it's handled, I think that oddly, I would imagine in those cultures, in the Victorian culture, because so many fucking people were dying of so many different things.
Yeah.
That there was a different type of acceptance and process around grief.
Of course there was. And also there was this formality, I guess, whereby, I don't know. I mean, there was a lot of grieving. Victoria was in black for a lot of her life. I mean, I went to a freaking school where we still wore a black tie out of grief for, and that started in the Victorian era. I thought, why are we still wearing a black tie? Oh, because of Prince Albert.
Really?
What Prince Albert? Oh, you know, Queen Victoria's husband. What?
That's where it started?
There was a lot about that school.
I guess it's just darkness.
Crazy. Yeah. And there is that. But, I don't know, there's this huge sort of burst of productivity in life and mechanization and energy with the Victorian era, but there's this huge slabbing kind of restriction of sort of sober conformity, like stay in your fucking lane, and if you don't,
weird moral judgment, restrictive.
I didn't look into the death thing so much. I saw it through Louis's eyes, I saw it through Will's scripting of it, which I just thought was so extraordinary the way, he just said, like, I just want you to come into the room, see it, and walk away from it.
Right.
And try and deal with it somewhere else.
Right. Well, I think that, like, for that guy to process it properly and not, I don't think there was any way that guy could integrate it properly.
No.
And I guess, like, where I'm going with this in my own curiosity, and you explained how you constructed that character. Mm. So when you approach a story like The Power of the Dog, which I didn't know what the fuck that movie was, when I got into it, like, it seems like this has happened to me a lot. I go see the movies and I don't read much about it, which is the only way to do it. I didn't know anything about Louis Wayne.
It's the best
zero.
Way, isn't it?
It's the best.
It's great. You have a discovery that's based on what the storytellers give you, right?
So I'm watching this sparse Western. It seems like it's going to be a Western. I have no idea where it's going. And then by, the third act, I'm like, what is happening? So so with that guy, with Phil Burbank and these brothers, I like Plemons and Dunst, and the kid was really good. Everyone was good. Yeah. But here you are in an American environment, like a classic American setting.
Yeah.
So you've got to like do that accent business.
Yeah.
But what do you do with that guy? Like when you read that script, what is the thing you see in it that makes you go, like, well, this is the engine of this guy? Outside of whatever repression we're dealing with. But I mean, what was it?
Well, that's kind of it. I mean,
that's it.
I think, the real fuel for him is how vulnerable he is, what his scar is and his secret. And it's a pretty big one. It's rare that you get to carry that sort of thing out of, anything other than the backstory, which is just that bit of the iceberg that's not actually on the screen, but you kind of need to give you that.
This whole thing is the unfolding of that. And so we don't want to spoil it.
Well, you get both, which is part of the gift. I mean, look, Jane Campion comes calling.
You're right.
Again, tick.
Yeah.
You see a part like that in a book like that, which I'd only had until after the conversation.
You read the book?
With Jane. I think the book is just a masterful piece of... It's really one of the greatest American novels.
Really?
Period. Oh, it's very special.
How is it new?
No, it was written in the 60s.
No kidding.
Mm, yeah, Thomas Savage. It's based on a family interaction, you know, his uncle, great uncle, I suppose.
Because it's almost like as a film, it almost plays like a fable within a fable.
Right.
Like after a certain point, you're like, is Bronco Henry real?
Oh, you thought that?
Sometimes.
Interesting.
Because, like, you know, the shrining of the saddle and all that stuff, I get that.
Yeah.
But it plays in that story on screen.
I guess you could question whether the stories are real.
It's a mythology.
At all. But yeah, he's almost a mythical figure,
right,
completely. But I think it's, and yeah, I see what you're saying about a story within a story. There is that this off-screen character who has a massive presence but isn't there too.
Yeah, and a massive presence that is multi-layered.
Yeah, completely.
You know, because your character is telling stories about this guy, and obviously the relationship between your character and Bronco Billy is something we don't understand.
Yeah.
And all the other guys are jumping around, hooting and hollering. And
thinking it's funny and what
yeah,
a guy,
right.
I wish we'd known him. And Jesse's character, my brother George, who, you know, we've run this ranch for 25 years. He taught us all, everything, both of us, everything we needed to know to make
it. But Jesse never talks about it.
And he's not interested. Well, this is the thing that happens at the beginning of the film. You meet these two characters who are brothers who live this very kind of codependent life. But one of them, guess what, is drifting towards the future and love.
Yeah.
And the other one is trying to hold back and celebrate the past. And it tears him apart. He sees his brother.
And he can't move forward from it.
He can't move forward from it. Because the only way he can live with his secret is to sort of, is to keep it alive in some way in the public vein, and then, you know, see privately how he does that as well.
But because of that, you know, that character, that kind of, you know, the repression that becomes antithetic, the opposite characterologically of what he is, in order to maintain face among the men, it's a huge problem.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
it is.
Like, it's a huge problem with fascism.
Yeah.
in some ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, they look under the hood of most monstrous people in history.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've had a couple of them pass through in this neck of the woods. And we've got them in Europe, and they're everywhere in the world, for Christ's sake. I was speaking to Brazilians today and thinking about him. And, you know, where is the repression? Where's the mum that didn't give the love, or the secret of the sexuality, or lack of authentic self lived? And how does that twist people into a pretzel of hate and bitterness and anger and rage? And, you know, that's where this film is important. We didn't set out to make a piece that was thematically based, but, you know, Jane's obviously somebody who's tackled aspects of this before, but more through a female lens of a female lead. But that was definitely one of the lures, I think, for her as an artist, wanted to tell this story. But it's just come about. I mean, the book is the most amazing blueprint for my character's characterization you can imagine. I mean, when you're talking about how to build a character and where those ideas
you had
come
it
from,
all there.
Massively. And then Jane's script, our discussion, the kind of investment we gave, the runway. I'm usually building a plane as it takes off because of scheduling. This time I had months to talk to her, admittedly, with some other projects that fitted around.
Yeah.
But, you know, we kind of both held this thing very, very delicately. We really wanted to get this man right because of his complexity and what Savage was carrying in it, and where it should take the audience, this abhorrent character that then you lean into through understanding and empathy. And we did everything. I mean, she said to me one day, have you ever tried dream therapy? And I went, no, Jen, I haven't. Well, I'm doing it. It's really good. He said, try it. Do you want to try it? And I said, absolutely. Really? And I said, yes, of course I do. Yeah. You're offering me another tool to get there. Let's dig deep.
Dream therapy.
Yeah. So I worked with an amazing woman called Kim Gillingham, who's a Jungian dream analyst.
How'd that go? What'd you
never
learn?
Ever say that word first time.
Sorry.
Right? And, no, I know it's fine. I always say analyst. I don't know what an analyst
like
is. An analyst.
Analyst.
And she's just an expert in that realm of seeing the subconscious.
Would you wake up and you got to write it down real
quick? Exactly, yeah. You have a journal and you kind of just write out what you can remember.
Were you surprised by what she said?
Yeah.
How did it help the character?
Because I found what I was dreaming to be very mundane. And guess what?
Sure.
You know, every now and again, I'd get Jane comparing her dreams, and it was like, you know, I'm paraphrasing it, but like lilies exploding with blood in someone's face. And I was okay, cool, you're Jane Campion.
Yeah.
I, meanwhile, are dreaming about leaving the oven on, or have I fucking left the house without the keys? Do you know what I mean?
Different
threshold
character.
Anxiety is about as high as my imaginative state.
It's a different character. That's a
different character.
Those are the ones that inform the Louis character and the other guy.
Exactly. But eventually stuff did come up. And even if it wasn't the mundane, it was kind of extraordinary. And yeah, what a great resource to be able to use, working when you're asleep. I mean, you shouldn't use it all the time because you do, I think, sleep a lot lighter.
I've
like lucid dreaming. Have you ever tried that?
I've done things where, like, you know, what I've noticed, and I don't necessarily write it down, but I there were moments where, especially when I was in, like, deep sadness, where if I would drift off for a second, it was like I had this whole other life that I had a lot of things. It wasn't a dream thing, though. It was sort of like I had a schedule, I had to be places.
Right, okay.
No, it was literally like an alternate world where I was living different life.
Wow.
And it seemed very real in those moments. And I'd wake up and I'd be like, holy shit, hope that guy's okay. He seemed to have a lot to do. You know, like there was
someone living a parallel existence in your dreams.
It was me.
That's amazing.
With a whole other, you know, set of things to do.
Yeah.
It was very, and it seemed very, it was like.
What if that is happening somewhere?
Well, that's the thing. It's almost like on your computer, if you have an Apple where it says guest user.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, you kind of sign into that one. And you're like, no, that's the other me.
You do that? That's amazing.
No, I don't do it, but that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
Like there's a whole other
there's
hard
a whole
drive.
Other iCal there.
Yeah.
With similar shit, but slightly different.
But slightly different. Yeah. That guy's doing better than I am.
He's got
a
hoverboard or whatever that is.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, hi, excuse me. This is me in the present, okay? I'm not talking to Benedict Cumberbatch right now. I'm talking to you. This is the part of the talk where it really became impossible for us to continue talking about the movie without getting into some of the details of what happens to the character. So, you listening? Listen. If you skip ahead exactly 10 minutes and 15 seconds from when I tell you to, you'll jump over that whole part of the talk. I can tell you this. This part wound up being a really great part of the conversation, and we were actually kind of arguing about the movie in a good way, the way you're supposed to argue about something provocative. So do what you want. Just don't say I didn't warn you if you haven't yet watched the film, all right? So you can skip ahead 10 minutes and 15 seconds right now. But, like, I thought that the resolution of that thing, like, it's weird, as empathetic as that guy became when he was able to, you know, at least have moments of sensitivity and connection with that kid.
Yeah.
I didn't feel bad.
About?
Well, I don't want to spoil too much.
You know. Oh, really? Okay, you're one of those guys. Okay, fine. That's okay. You like beginning, middles, and end. That's fine.
No, but I mean, like, when whatever happened.
No, I get you.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're saying. I know what we can't say, but it's sort of there in the book. But yeah, it's weird.
Well, no. It's like, I want people to have the experience. I don't think
I'm a Marvel guy, and I infuriate fans by saying, I'm not going to give anything away before the film comes out.
Huge reveals, but it's kind of a clever thing, and it's the turn.
It kind of is.
That's the third act.
In terms of this story, it is.
Yeah.
It's a huge,
And it's
really, we kind of danced it around in such an obvious way. I think people could pick it together.
Not in a specific way. But like, that moment where
Netflix will not be ringing us saying what the fuck. Okay, right.
They're all right. They'll be all right. Netflix is gonna be fine. But that moment where
didn't have any empathy for a man who's not able to live his life.
I had empathy.
He didn't have.
I'm
any
saying I had
it.
Empathy.
Yeah, but it's the way it should end.
Yeah, no, I think it's obviously the way it should end. But when the moment that it goes down.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, my heart was with the kid.
Right.
Like, as dark as that kid is.
Yeah.
And as seemingly emotional.
It's a shame. I think it should be more confusing than that. But yeah, people will do that.
It's obviously confusing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, how many people did that guy break? At what point is karma? I understand empathy.
Yeah,
At what point does karma become operative? You know, in reaping what you sow on some level.
For sure. But the tragedy of it is it's just at the point that he's transforming, that he's becoming.
Is he though?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's melting into something that's utterly different. He's no longer in the position where it's just a power trip to try and rip the umbilical cord away from
with the
mother,
kid.
You know, by recruiting him. Yeah, he's not just a tool in
he's
destroying
just saying
the mother.
He's falling in love with the kid.
Or destroying the kid
he's
himself.
He's falling in love with him.
He's, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, again, we're really in spoiler territory. For fuck's sake, it's like the entire fifth act. But, you know, there is a shift at the end of this film, ladies and gentlemen. That's
I'll tell you though, that turn, you know, where you know you miss your character sort of misunderstands the depth of that character's emotional callousness,
completely.
And he just kind of snaps the neck of that rabbit, and you're like,
and
what?
Like, whoa, okay, I know. That's not who I thought I was having a picnic with. Yeah, exactly.
It's all very reminiscent. Like, there are moments where it's reminiscent of, like, Dahmer. There's moments where it's reminiscent of a potential serial killer in terms of his disposition.
Wow.
You know, his detachment. And you start to question the repercussions of his necessary repression, right?
I wish we could talk about the whole film. It's so frustrating. Because, of course, it leaves you in a place where you're going, I wonder what's going to happen next. You know, and what's his scar from this?
Where's the horror movie sequel?
Does he
sequel?
Just shut the door on that, or is there exactly? Or does he turn into Anthony Perkins?
And I also and I also think that Plemons' character, the one thing that you start to realize with his, you know, you calling him fatso all the time and or whatever it is, and then his lack of ability to communicate properly. But he's also the one that didn't have the relationship that you had with Bronco Henry.
True.
So, you know, like, and he knows what happened. right?
Oh, you think he does?
Of course That's he has to. So he's got to shut that shit down.
Of course he has to.
Sure.
Why?
Because everyone knows. You know, if you're getting, you don't think your brother fucking knows?
Do they, though? I think you could see the obsession and wonder, but does he actually know that something
Hey, look, if that kid could find the secret fort, you don't think the fucking brother could who you grew up with?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Mm. Well, that's, I mean.
It's a question for Jesse, but.
I don't know. I didn't read the book, so you know something I don't know.
I just think there's such a disconnect with this brother. He needs him because that is who he runs his life with.
The disconnect with Jesse.
He can't get it. He can't. It's not just. It's in this. It's very in that moment, but in the book and in their relationship throughout their life before this moment that we meet them, where they're drifting apart completely. He's tried to engage him. He's tried to make him someone who's invested in the world, who's curious, who's just wanting to be more than just existing, and he can't.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's really rich enough makeup for someone to kind of completely understand.
Well, not understand.
Something that would have had to be. Well, I just think it's very easy from the 21st century perspective to go, right, okay, yeah, the kid got it. Yeah, he's ticking off the bully. That's great. Oh, right, that guy, he understands his brother, but he's just sucking it up like he does every.
I don't think he understands
every kind of body shaming insult. I think if you look at 1925 culture, where this man could not, my character Phil, could not be who he really was because of it being illegal. Let alone culturally unacceptable, societally unacceptable,
and personally unacceptable,
unlawful, and just and personally, for himself, he probably doesn't even fully understand it before it's cut short. In the book, he sees Bronco being trampled to death in a corral when he's 19. You know,
wow! I got to read this book. So,
it's
but
great.
But I guess if we get deeper, we're gonna
I don't want to get into an arm wrestle about your perspective because I think a lot of people share it, and it just the thing is, I get defensive of Phil in a sense, not because I played him. But because, I think there should be ambiguity about what is. It's not black and white. It's not just a vengeance drama about somebody stopping.
No, I don't think it is, and I didn't. And that was not the feeling I got.
Okay,
it was just
Has to do what the kid has to do. I think that, and that's the propulsion of the tragedy in a way, because just when there is a possibility, I think really a door opening of. Oh, this guy's behavior is going to mellow. This is going to be a tutor-mentor relationship with something else potentially involved.
Fine. Yeah, but
the mother is going to recover from her alcoholism. It's been discovered. George is on it. No, by the way, fine. You know, alcoholism doesn't just get cured overnight. But if the source of her terror is something that's being pacified by a new relationship with the son... I think there's a moment of hope for him to. I mean, maybe I'm being naive about it, but how many people is he broken? Sure, but it still goes back to.
Yeah, but still, the assumption is the moment of hope is like, that means that, somehow or another.
I guess what I'm saying in a very kind of liberal way is I do not believe in vindictive justice. I believe in restorative justice. I believe the idea that people should be examined and understood and not just locked up and thrown away. Otherwise, the problem keeps existing.
Of course, I believe that too, but I'm talking about the movie. we're making movies here. So it's like, I believe all those things too, but I think in the movie that I saw,
it's the only satisfying outcome. I agree.
It's a satisfying outcome, but also if you understand people and you believe in restorative justice and all that stuff, there's no reason to believe that that guy overnight because of that kid is going to change his ways for the duration of it. It doesn't make what he wants and what he does any more legal or comfortable or anything else. So however that's going to go.
If he's meeting someone who's comfortable with who he is, and if he falls in love with someone who becomes openly gay, but not openly gay, of course he can't do that, but there's a secretive love affair.
Sure.
He's sure enough not going to go on hating on Rose. Why would he bother?
Okay, he may not hate on Rose, but what's he going to do about all those fucking roughnecks? What's he going to do about his brother?
He will be the same alpha male, but he will not, he doesn't need to control things in the same way as I think he does if he's living with a secret by a river where he gets naked every 3 months.
Sure.
You know.
Okay, I get it. Yeah, so
I just think we can really underestimate what that damage was that he lived with his life as a 21st century audience.
No, I get it. So but you put this in order to make this guy, these were thoughts that you had to have
for sure. So I can't undo them. I'm getting hot in here. It's getting so fucking heated.
but
I can see things objectively, but I think what I have a problem with sometimes in the Q&A afterwards, and it's like, cheers for Peter, and God damn it, men are fucking assholes, and poor Rose, sympathy for her as a victim. I think if you just go hero, victim, nice guy George and baddie, I just feel then it's like, oh, we're doomed to be telling this story again in 100 years.
Yeah, you know? I get that. But like what I'm telling you is, you know, I didn't feel good. Like, I didn't have any high hopes for the kid either.
Oh, really? Interesting. Because there's a bill to pay there, you mean?
Of course.
Yeah. That's interesting.
From the beginning, there's a bill to pay. That, you know,
and what's Cody's got it down. What he says when we've talked about it in public to people again who've seen the film, but he says, you know, he, and I think all of us had this reaction when we first encountered the material, fresh as audience, you know, do when they see this film.
Right.
It is our misjudgment of this character that is the character arc of that character. He is who he is at the beginning of the film.
The kid. Yeah. Cody. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's what you're alluding to now. And I completely agree with that. Like, yeah. It's just a slow reveal because guess what?
Yeah, it's a slow reveal, but I'm not, I didn't think
we're misstepped through the storytelling purposely, you know.
But on some level, you know, that kid's transgression is much deeper than yours and much more horrible. So it's not like, you know,
I know. Yeah, it's not black and white. I know.
I don't see him as the hero.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, you know, the sort of the provocative nature of that dynamic and how they both paid for whatever the fuck they are. It's horrible, but that guy doesn't go on to live a dandy life in the city.
Maybe
he does.
Maybe he writes a novel about it. Maybe that's Thomas Savage's secret. No, I shouldn't say that. His family is still alive and they're very supportive of the film. But, you know, it's based on a true story.
Yeah. Holy shit. Yeah. So, all right. So when do you, you grew up with actors?
I did. Mark, can I ask you something again?
You go to the bathroom?
No, I'm fine. Oh. I am slightly worried about how much we've talked about stuff that we can't reveal. Is that cool?
What part do you not want to reveal?
It depends when this is coming out as well. I mean, once this is on Netflix, hopefully people have seen it. But if this podcast is like next week, I'm like, ooh.
I don't know. We'll figure it out. I hope we don't lose all of it. It's good.
I know.
What were the instructions you got?
What, from Jane?
Yeah.
Oh, from what to talk about?
Yeah.
It's difficult because I've just done an interview with a guy who's, you know, it's going to come out on the LA Times or something like in January. So I was like, yeah, baby, let's just get all of it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't live in the UK and like you seem to have been at it for a long time.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah. I'm sort of a 17-year overnight success kind of thing. Sherlock was the sort of big leap into the limelight, I guess, which translated internationally for me.
But before that, you were a big stage actor as well?
Yeah, and theater and some film as well, yeah.
But where does it start? Like, how does it, like you grew up with a
mum and dad, both actors.
Both actors?
Yeah.
Working actors?
Yeah.
And big actors. Do you, like, the name you have, it seems like a big complicated name, Benedict.
My dad was advised to change it. Everyone said people won't be able to say it or remember it.
But is it one of those families that goes back? I mean, do you, is there something similar in class to the Louis Wayne character? Like, are you bordering on royalty of any kind?
Oh, or? God, I don't know. But there was one thing when I spoke at the internment of Richard III's body, and somebody had worked out on the day or a few days before that there was some lineage and some relation to him.
Oh, really?
I mean, you know, that's, it's a small island. What can I say? I don't know.
But deeply British.
But no, it was a bit of research, and it made me, I guess it made me feel a little bit more.
The internment of Richard.
I just played him in a BBC adaptation of The Hollow Crown, the series that Sam Mendes did, and for Dominic Cook, who directed all three of our plays. I played him from when he first appears in The Henrys to Richard III itself. And I guess that was the first correlation that meant, oh, okay, we could ask him to read this beautiful poem by Caroline Duffy, the ex poet laureate. And boy, can she write something absolutely extraordinary for the occasion. It was in the internment. So there was the whole thing of the king in the car park, right? They found his body underneath NCP and, you know, a car park firm's
tarmac. How'd they know it was him?
You know, carbon dating, stuff that was around him. I can't actually remember all the details, but it was, we were all there because it was verified. It was real.
So then they properly buried him?
Properly buried him.
When was this?
Oh, I want to say about... Well, at least 6 years ago now.
Wow, I don't know that story.
Yeah.
Huh.
So I guess that's my closest link to royalty.
So,
not a long history of actors either. I mean, mum and dad were the first generation to do that in their families, and it was very much frowned upon when they said.
What was the family mostly like?
Mum came from a pretty sort of middle to working class background. Dad was a wine trader and a desert rat in the Second World War. Brigade that fought Rommel. My dad's side, my grandmother on that side came from a sort of an English family that owned, I think, a tea estate in India or something, and his dad was a submarine commander, and his uncle was in the diplomatic. It's a bit of a line in that.
Huh.
And it goes back, and then goes back. There's lots of history. Lots, as I've been discovering.
Exciting.
And, yeah.
Exciting British history. And, yeah, you got the full spectrum of CMC.
Yeah, yeah. All of it, the good and the very bad.
And your wife's British?
She is, yes.
100%?
Sophie.
Kind of?
Yeah, well, I didn't...
All the way back?
I didn't... That wasn't a prerequisite.
No, but I'm just curious because, like you said, it's a small island. So, like, you know, you kind of wonder because, like, this is a country built on immigrants. You're not going to find any
quite right,
pure
yeah.
blood.
I know, you know? No, of course not. And so that whole idea of nationhood
yeah.
and nationalism, it's what's so fucking ridiculous about it. And this state we're in now where we're like,
well, now it's
shut them out. Don't let any more of them in, the others.
And you think, viral.
It's,
yeah.
it's horrible.
No, it's terrible. Yeah.
It's really horrible. And you just think, come on, what are we composed of here?
I know. We're all the same.
You know.
So when you're growing up, though, do you, like, I imagine there's something about having parents who are actors and seeing them on stage and then not on stage. You kind of, a couple of things happen, I guess.
Yeah.
You realize the job of it.
Yeah.
Completely. And you also realize the transformative power of it.
Yeah.
And you realize that there is a craft to it.
Yeah.
All those things.
Yeah. Yeah. And a community and
a very exciting
enjoyment of it. And
community.
Absolutely. And a diverse community, you know. Just
yeah.
seeing a crew and a cast hang out after a rap party, seeing...
At the house, I imagine. At your house?
Someone's house. No, it wasn't our house. No, we Mum and Dad have a flat in Kensington, which they've had since the 70s.
Yeah.
Something like $3,000. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's always one of those things, as you know, posh boy brought up in Kensington. Well, yeah, I'm certainly very privileged background and upbringing,
yeah.
but it was a flat that Mum bought for £3,000.
And that's where they
and
stay.
And there's still the same paisley wallpaper in the bathroom. Yeah, yeah.
And, so the parties were at the house of the producers?
Oh, it was another actor. I think it was Murray Watson of that particular production.
Yeah.
A lovely, great late actor of our country and a dear friend whose granddaughter, I'm actually godfather to.
Uh-huh.
Him and me and her daughter were really good friends. And I sort of had my first boyhood crush on her, Emma Watson. And not the Emma Watson, but another one.
Yeah.
And... yeah, I remember being at her wedding and everyone turned around. If anyone knows any due impediment by these two, you know, and everyone turned around, I was just kind of smiling cheekily. But a bit of an age gap.
Yeah,
it was very sweet. Very sweet. And I adore that family. And so, I remember that party. But I also, you saw about the transformative thing. I remember standing on the back of, I can't remember what production it was, but it was a comedy and it was in the West End. I think it was a Ray Cooney farce, potentially, because Mum did a lot of those in the 80s and 90s.
I don't even know what that is.
Farce or Ray Cooney?
No, Ray Cooney.
He's a farcer.
Oh yeah,
he's a writer of farce.
Yeah. And it's a British thing.
It's a very British thing.
Okay,
full of lots of sort of double entendre and people compromising positions,
and
it's but based on the kind of Fado model of like opening and shutting doors, and you know the pace builds up, and the you know the stakes get higher and higher, it gets more and more ridiculous.
It's an entertaining thing.
Yeah, man. And I saw Mum just in the wings, kind of chatting to somebody about to cue her, and then. Actually not cue, what am I talking about? I don't think there was that. It's not a live show. So it must have been just probably the stage manager doing her cues.
Yeah.
And I
she's
remember
about
sat
to
at
go
the side
on.
And you know, there's this the flats around, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's just
yeah.
like there's nothing there that speaks of the world she's about to enter.
Yeah.
And I just saw this sort of drop of her and this opening of the door, this blast of heat and light, and my mum just becoming someone else and walking out into this world where there were people watching her.
Yeah,
I was like, what is that?
Yeah, yeah.
What
yeah,
is
yeah.
that? That's crazy.
That's the best part.
Seen.
It's the best part.
She was my mum, and I just suddenly saw
how old
this
were you?
Shift. I can't remember, young, you know.
But there's that world, the world of the wings is the best part of showbiz.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Because
like,
you just step through the door, and it's immediate transformation.
Yeah.
This whole thing of method is like, you turn it on and off. You have to. You can't go around being the person you're on stage all the time. I take my hat off to anyone who does, or even more the people that suffer that work.
But that's method. Like the weird thing about dues paying and about like, you know, the experience, like no matter what your training is, like when you walk out there, there's some part of you that is naturally going to open up to that.
Yes.
And you know, and that's all you're hoping for.
Yeah.
Is that like you no longer fear that.
Yeah.
And you don't have to worry about that part.
Or that the fear propels you to be brave and to go into that darkness and unknown and tell
sure,
us
sure, sure, but like
well,
at some point you can't be afraid to be out there.
No, you've got to do it because an audience is going to come in and watch it.
Yeah. And if you're afraid to be out there, they're going to feel it and you're not going to be accessible.
No, because you'll want to control stuff and you'll want to be safe and
do you
all
have brothers and
it.
Sisters?
I had a sister. Yeah.
Oh.
My mum from my mum's first marriage who sadly passed away before Christmas. She died of cancer. She'd been battling it for 7 years.
Oh, God. Sorry.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Life is terrible.
As the great, greatly awful Donald Rumsfeld said, shit happens, but or stuff happens, I think.
Yeah,
he said.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's horrible. It's
but,
horrible.
So I guess the
she was nothing to do with this world. That was the other thing. Like, she was markedly different. She was an artist. She went to the same university as I ended up going
to my sister, Trax.
Yeah, yeah, she was brilliant artist, a brilliant fine artist, but ended up doing a lot of restorative work on, well, canvas, but also on the frames and marquetry
for old stuff?
Antiques. Yeah,
that's great.
But still kept her hand in and did her own work and made the most beautiful Christmas and celebratory cards of any kind of festival. And yeah, she was very gifted. And mum is as well. She started as an artist, but then, you know,
visual artist,
salacious director. No, she was a scenic artist, actually. She was a set deck, and she this
in
director
theater,
who sort of took a shine to her, usually in front of the set, all that fruitiness. And she went, oh, okay, and got into Central at the same time as Judi Dench and Vanessa Redgrave and that great swathe of young British talent. And those are her peers.
And, oh, really?
Yeah.
I just saw Kenneth Branagh's new movie.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
Belfast.
Yeah, is it good?
Yeah. It's it's personal.
Yeah.
It's black and white. It's heavy. I didn't know any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because
I
live here.
Yeah.
And I didn't know the beginning of the Troubles and what that must have felt like as a kid.
I mean, can you imagine? Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
But again, not unlike whatever the subtext of The Power of the Dog is, you know, you're dealing with a fracturing of the people.
Absolutely.
Around
political
lines. And you know, these are neighbors.
Yeah.
That's the fucked up thing that people don't realize is, like, neighbors will kill neighbors.
For sure.
And it's happened over and over again.
Every single page of history is full of it.
It's the worst. One day it just turns on and there you go.
And it's not just the other against the other. It's people who live on the same street. You're
and
right,
you've
you know?
Known for your whole life.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fucked up.
It is fucked up.
Yeah. So I guess the benefit of having actor parents is that, you know,
you get a reality check.
They were supportive too, right?
Completely. Of course they were, but not all the way not at the beginning, because they wanted me to do anything. But, you know, this peripatetic life, this uncertain income, this not being able to plan your life, blah, blah, blah. You know, and you know, as parents, they grieve some of that, you know, school holidays cut into by dad having to fly off back from Greece, where we often went as a family to do an advert call that he didn't get. But that was the end of him in
that
Greece with
so
us as a family.
Sad.
It's shit. And but, you know, so it was a reality check. I had no romantic notions. I just wanted to do what they did. I wanted to earn a living, and I wanted to have the respect of my peers and have a great time.
But
and that's what I saw them doing.
Were they disappointed? Are they disappointed? Did their careers, bitterness and no, like...
Oh, God, no. No, which again is a huge thing to do with how egoless both of them are.
Well, that's rare.
Yeah. My dad is rare in particular, I think. Mum had a lot of she was in the limelight a lot. My mum's Wanda Ventham, and she was in a series called The Lotus Eaters in the BBC, as well as sort of award-winning drama like Breakdown and all sorts of stuff. And she was very well known. She was picked up by Gerry Anderson to be this sort of the live-action version of the Thunderbirds thing he did called UFO. She was in a lot of cult stuff. She was in Hammer Horror films.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, she's guested in a lot of great, great stuff from Only Fools and Horses.
Oh, so she really had the thing.
Yeah, she's known. She was the one in the frozen pea section of the kind of supermarket who would be stopped by someone saying, wait, I know you. What, you're you're that Sheila Gish, aren't you? No, I'm not. No, yeah, you are. You're in that musical. You're in, that's on. I'm thinking, no, that's Sheila Gish. I'm Wanda Ventham. Who? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know you. I had all of that kind of...
The
pre-selfie
the
kind
almost,
of thing.
Almost star.
Just like not getting... Well, just people just
I get that
occupying
a
moment with me and my mum by... interviewing her
trying to figure out who she is
it's just like weird and then the worst is I kind of get into elevator. I mean she is beautiful, really beautiful, and she was a bit of a pin-up, and you know it's very odd when you get into an elevator with a man who's twice your age and goes, oh yeah, your mum,
yeah
I like your mum, and you think, Christ, get me out
but it's nice, I guess.
Oh,
you know?
It's a compliment to her beauty, but I don't really need to hear it from the person who is
creepy.
About
her. So you But they, once you, your interest was undeniable, they were like, okay.
There was a turning point. There was a moment where at university, it took a while, I had to prove to them that I was willing to do further education to have something to fall back on.
Although I did
a drama degree. I didn't do like, you know, maths and economics or
in undergraduate
French
or
diplomacy
before...
or something. No, I was an undergrad, yeah. So it was just a master's. But I then did there was nothing about acting to do with it at all. It was about writing. It was about
drama.
Theater and prisons of probation.
Okay,
those are the kind of practical elements.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was also a huge two-third chunk of it that was academic. So everything from studying kind of like, you know, Werner Herzog and Fassbinder and
to Greek tragedy and that,
yeah,
everything.
To stage design in the Restoration era or post-war American theater. So this everything.
This was what would make them comfortable if you had a broad education of everything that went into theater. So like,
No. That wasn't done to please them. Even then, it was a turning point because I was like, like I said, if I wanted to be a lawyer or a diplomat or anything else that would be more grown up in their eyes and more assured as a living or way to live a life, then, you know, I would have chosen a different degree in a different university in a different... So already they knew it was going that way. But there was just a decisive point after a production of of Amadeus that I did at university where I played Salieri, and Dad just got hold of my shoulders in the car park and said, you're better at this than I ever was or ever will be, and I can't wait to see what you do, and we're so excited to see it and support you all the way. It completely.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's an amazing.
Did you cry? Between it.
I guess I did. I mean, I feel like choking up every time
I choking up.
It's a beautiful thing. To say to his son, what a gift of a blessing. And that is their love. That's what it's been like.
Well, is selfless, especially for an actor who generally requires an inordinate amount of ego, and that is easily threatened. That he was able to be that selfless in showing you his belief in you.
Yeah,
that's a gift.
It was amazing.
So then, where'd you go? Where'd you study?
I went to Lambda for a year, which they were a bit against. They're like, "You're ready, just get on with it." And I wanted to, you know, be with my peers and just figure out the stuff that wasn't working, the stuff that was.
That's the Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Yeah, the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts.
That's the big completely. One.
It's one of the two, RADA and Lambda, the big London-based ones. That's really unfair. Guildhall. I mean, I am president of that drama school, so I would say it's the big one. Or one of the two, but there's some great drama schools in London. There's Guildhall, Sylvia Young, and all sorts of other different places. East 17.
So did you go there and get hammered with Shakespeare?
No, a little bit of classical English theatre training. That's what the year was about. But really, the kind of key lessons and things that I locked into and still served me well were just tiny vignettes and different classes. Could be an Alexander technique class, could be a movement class, could be just working with one director who was like, do nothing. Just say it. Just do fucking nothing.
Right.
I was very much in my sort of adolescent and pre-adolescent stage just hatboxing. I was just going, and I've been given the chance to go from playing Rosalind in As You Like It to playing Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman at school in a year.
Yeah.
After my balls dropped. Sorry for the visual image, but, it was an all-boys school. So I played girls in the Shakespeare productions, and then, hello, I'm an aging salesman.
When you were a kid?
Arthur Miller. Yeah, I was 17 when I played Willie Loman.
But that was not at Lamb. That was not at
No, that was at school. But my point is, I was hatboxing. I was just trying on these very rich, different, varied characters. Just going all out to sort of transform, I guess. And then Lambda was more about, no, you walk into the room, it's you.
Yeah.
What's that like?
And what was it like?
Pretty limiting casting wise. It's just like you immediately fit a box. It's just that beginning stage where they go, okay, he can do the officer class posh kid or whatever,
right?
And then you go, well, yeah, I can, but I'm actually going to say no to that and try to get the other part and whatever it might be. And
so really they're casting minded.
I think they just want to give you a security in the marketplace when you immediately emerge. I mean,
but they see a marketplace, which is good, and it's beyond,
a little.
I think
there is also a very cloistered and in a good way kind of closeted experience of exploring what acting is, what bringing truth to a moment, an imagined moment is,
right?
How to investigate a script, how to deal with different methodologies, and also not that it was on our 1 year course, but the 2 and 3 year course have a lot of work with cameras and recording as well of all sorts, plus medium and the written word. But it just, when you get to that I already had an agent, so that was okay. I got one by doing by playing Jerry in The Zoo Story in Edinburgh Fringe.
Edward Albee,
which is where I first met my wife, actually. But
really?
We've known each other for a long time. It was another production I was doing when
what's
I met her.
What's her name?
Sophie Hunter. And she was getting into a hooker's nightie, and I was stripping out of a wet sort of sweat-soaked fat suit, having been playing George in Kvetch's Stephen Berkoff play of Brilliance. I was just head over heels, but I was a goofball. I didn't know how to speak to women. I was all over the place and just was kind of accompany her going, oh, you're amazing. And just,
how old were you?
I would have been 1920, I think.
So, and she's an actress.
She is a director.
Director. Now.
Yeah.
Of what?
Opera and events and classical music and and also of straight drama and sort of
classic stuff
as well.
Or interesting or like, you know, like
well, she's working on an amazing production of The Carmelites with a fantastic architect. Am I going to forget the name of? Fuck, what's his name? He's very, very
architect.
Famous Spanish.
So it sounds like it doesn't sound non-traditional stuff that she does.
Kind of. And I think her, you know, a lot of. Well, I shouldn't be doing an interview for her, but you know, she's better at talking about her work than I am. But she, you know, she wants to democratize the sort of elevated experience of seeing classical music. She wants to broaden its appeal and give it an accessibility that's not cheapening the brilliance of it, but that is. Somehow to do with scale.
Well, that's good that people have been trying to do that with classical theater for years. And maybe it's time for music.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, she's getting into producing as well. There's an amazing book that we've got in our production company called The End We Start From that her sister-in-law, Megan Hunter. I mean, my sister-in-law as well, Megan, who married Tim, her brother, has written The End We Start From. It's just an amazing story about the early stages of motherhood with this catastrophic environmental disaster in the background, this flooding of London, this sort of event to do.
Oh, my God. I guess that's where we're going in terms of reflecting the world we're living in.
A little.
Catastrophic, apocalyptic, and can the human spirit persevere?
Yeah, and I think we need more of that, actually.
Of course.
I do. And I think we also need some solutions and prompts to know
motivators.
How better to live our life. Absolutely. Sure, it needs to be more present.
Yeah, I don't know how you get someone from knowing something to being taking action.
Neither do I. And I think we're you know, the biggest fault that we have as a species is short-termism. We can't see far enough to understand that our actions today have such a profound impact in generations to come.
Yeah, and also we're completely overwhelmed with information, tasks, the pace of the way we live now.
But truthfully, I think also we give ourselves more credit than we deserve for the individual changes that we are capable of making.
Yeah,
I try not
to give myself any credit.
It's a hiding to nothing in my position, that's for sure.
You don't want to direct?
I'd love to, yeah.
When's that going to happen?
Probably when the kids are older. It's so all consuming, you know. I just want to be, I love what I've got.
Have you been approached to do it? Like, has your agent
actually,
sat
really,
down and gone,
no,
so do you want to direct
a couple of times people have said, I'd love you to direct an episode or do something.
Of like Sherlock and that kind of stuff?
No, they're very protective over that shit. They wouldn't let me anywhere near.
A Marvel movie?
Oh, yeah, likewise, protective. I'm joking. I want to start small anyway. I wouldn't want that kind of...
Taika was in the Louis movie.
He was, yeah. He's a good friend.
Oh, he's a good friend of yours?
Yeah.
He's great. Yeah.
And Will and Cole, who does the voiceover, Olivia Colman.
Yeah.
Collie. But, you know, he was around and he was just in that sort of manic phase of just saying yes to everything. And we got him for a couple of days or an afternoon. I can't remember. It was really brief, but he just like set the whole crew alight. It was wonderful.
But like, he's a guy that like has a beautiful personal artistic vision that's able to apply it to a Marvel movie with some success.
And I love that about them letting him in. And I know they were jittery about it, but that's an example of where that works, where the house style is still there, but you have someone who has a really individual voice who's going to do something that shakes it up.
Yeah. And what
I'm
is it
so
like to
fresh, that film.
To play, like, you know, when you deal with these guys that you play, because you play people that are real a few times. Most of them are dead, I think.
Yeah, but some very alive and then coming more alive. Like Dominic Cummings, no one really knew who he was until he kind of broke lockdown and did everything he did as the Prime Minister's personal aide during COVID. But yeah, I was outside of the corridors of Westminster, no one really knew who he was. And then James Graham, this amazing political satirist, but also just this writer who has the ability to put you in the room where it happens in a
that's
really
great.
Kind of profound way. Like, okay, do you have a bug in that room? And that's how you get people are very freaked out because, you know.
And Julian Assange.
Julian Assange again, yeah. I mean, he was far better known and still alive, I hope.
How did he feel about about your depiction?
About his depiction? My depiction of him?
Yeah. Do you know?
It's been a while.
Was he freaked out?
How does he feel about it? I thought
how does he feel about it?
Oh, there was a very spicy email conversation that happened on like the morning of the first day of shooting where he was
like, go fuck yourself.
Desist. Well, no, very polite, but like very much like you have a moral obligation not to tell this story. We're trying to do good work here and you're going to torpedo it. And I said, I don't think this film will torpedo at heart what is essential about creating a platform whereby you can publish whistleblowers anonymously. That is a great thing you did for democracy, but this examines the personal relationship you had with that enterprise and the people involved, and you are very public, and that's there are certain things you did brilliantly and certain things that should be held up for examination.
Right.
The idea was beautiful.
How do you respond to that?
Oh, with another load of emails, and we kept writing to him. For me, he was very flattering. He was very sweet about it. He said, "Oh, we should publish these and give them to Vanity Fair." I'm like, oh, Christ, well, I am writing to a publisher, so I spent some hours trying to think of, you know,
a way to
really where I was with the argument. And I'm not against him. I'm not against what he did at all. I think it's extraordinary what he did. There were some provocative moves that were about personal politics and a human being, not about the ideal.
Sure.
That
this sounds like
can be held up for speculation.
It sounds like it'd be a good play, these correspondences.
Oh, stop. Well, I don't know. It's a while since I've seen him. But, you know, he's in a terrible hold at the moment. It's pretty dark.
I don't know what's going on.
He's in Belmarsh, and he's being held there for quite some time. He's not been in the embassy for a long time now.
Uh-huh.
He has a family. He has two kids with one of his lawyers that he sees, but from a prison.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a...
But there's this is a huge conversation.
I don't feel equipped to have it.
I don't think I do anymore.
He's gotten
dusty.
Away from it a bit.
Well, I wouldn't be doing it any service by saying I'm on it and I really have a clear line.
How do you manage your family when you are doing so many movies?
They really are the priority. You know, it's like most people.
Do they go with you?
Yeah, if it's someone like New Zealand, and if it's cool with Sophie's work and what their scheduling is.
You got stuck there too, didn't you?
For New Zealand, which was a blessing in disguise. It was amazing. It was amazing.
It's good family time.
I mean, yeah, not that anyone knew that at the time. We were kind of sanitizing groceries and not going outside our house for fear that drift through the letterbox.
Right.
But once we kind of understood where we were, which we'd never been before, and. Well, the predicament was I always had my parents, you know. They came over for like a 3-week visit, a week to acclimatize and meet Jane and see what we were doing on the South Island and watch me kind of cattle steer like 100 head of cattle through a village or whatever. And then go on a 2-week road trip that we'd planned together. And by the end of that, it was like, I think it's too risky for you to travel. By then, it was a really circuitous route home. It's like 3 days almost on
a
steel.
So they stayed too?
Yeah, for five months. So It was crazy.
Wow.
And, you know.
That is crazy. So you got to know each other even more than you thought.
Oh, yeah.
What is the story about you getting kidnapped?
Oh, wow. Okay, we're going there. I got kidnapped.
Were you on
a set? I got carjacked. No, I was on a weekend off with two other
Where was
actors.
This?
This is in South Africa.
What were you doing there?
I was doing a TV three-parter of a William Golding trilogy called To the Ends of the Earth. And I was playing the sort of landlubberly gent, Edmund Talbot, and he's on this boat and it becomes this sort of metaphor, as everything does, whether it's an island or for Golding's kind of,
right.
You know, pressurizing environment to study the human condition and how it falls apart and what societal strains and weaknesses there are in certain eras that expose the true nature of our animal being and all the rest
of
that.
Is he the Lord of the Flies guy?
Yeah.
Right.
And Aspire. Martin, he's an amazing writer, but this is a great role, great part, and I was two-thirds of the way through. And the three of us had wanted to go off and learn to dive, to do, you know, like get a PADI certificate, go scuba diving.
Right.
And we had this, you know, course, and it was very kind of method-based, and there was just a little bit of practice of breathing underwater, but it was in a pool. It wasn't out at sea.
Sure.
They did it safely, and it was cold. It was getting to be a South African winter, and I kind of felt a little sick, and I go, guys, I think we should go back tonight rather than early tomorrow morning before we start filming Monday.
Yeah.
And the South African with us, he was like, it's kind of sketchy out there at night. I think we should just wait until the day. I went, okay, it's just, I don't feel great. He went, okay, well, we'll find a route.
Yeah.
And we went, and I feel really guilty about that. I wish we had gone in the morning, given what happened. And we drove the section that we thought would be a little sketchy, the kind of more unstructured road, the kind of dirt track to get to the N2, which is this big trunk road that runs all the way down the east coast of Africa.
Uh-huh.
We didn't get far down it when one of the tires blew. We got out to try and fix it because what we didn't know is you could run for quite a while on three tires. So anyone listening, keep driving, you know. We stopped, and then out of the bush, these guys came and threw us back into the car, drove us off road, plundered the car, and it was a pretty
armed
deal.
People?
It was about 2 hours long. yeah, there was, well, there was intimation of a gun, but I didn't turn around to see it because by the time we were out of the car, I was then put in the boot of the car, as surety at one point with my shoelaces as a bind for my hand and my wrists.
Oh my God. So you're in the trunk?
And I had to, yeah. And I kind of argued my way. I said, look, I'm going to be a problem for you because I might die in here. I have, it's the small space. Uh-huh. It's not the fact I can't breathe. I have a problem with being a small, which is not true, really. Although I was definitely, I thought I've got to give them a reason why this isn't a good idea, you know?
Yeah.
I can't plead for my life. It's very much the way that if that happens in a family, the child is taken as surety and the parents are left. I mean, it's so, we learned a lot that night. And I was dragged out, having argued my way out of it. And we were all sort of tied together up the side of this embankment, three of us. Yeah.
And how'd they find you? Who found you?
They eventually left us alone once we gave cards and drew out money. We'd used our cash to pay, so the whole deal might have been over far quicker if we'd had cash, and they'd just taken the stuff out of the car, and the car, obviously, they might have left us alone, but because of needing to take a card to a bank machine, it lasted for like 2.5 hours.
Oh, shit.
So we then walked down the road away from where it had happened, and...
You got unbound?
Yeah, and we kind of got to this roadside...
Oh my God.
Marquee of these two women, which were selling these fantastic goods that the Koti tribe, the local tribe, had been making.
Yeah.
These beautiful, like beaded bowls and wooden carvings outside Shislui game reserves, one of those drive through safaris. And we just waited with them and a security guard and called the production company. And yeah, the cavalry came and picked us up in our shaken form. It was heavy. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we were so lucky. I mean, literally the next day in the paper, there was a guy got killed at a road stop, and all that was in his car was a 2-rand coin and a lighter. And, the guy got blown away at the lights, just the opportunism to just take whatever might have been in there. It's just...
Got lucky.
But yeah, and we were very lucky in a very big country.
How does that... inform you? How does that...
Well, I went back there. I mean, I stayed out for a period of time afterwards. I also went traveling on my own in Namibia, and I think I kind of got this weird thing, which I'm still processing as well, a little of... needing to live a life less ordinary at a kind of pace or I don't know, a level of looking over the ledge and being in control of my mortality that's not necessarily very productive. But in that moment, I became an adrenaline junkie. I hung out with South African special forces and did, you know, helicopter flights and jumped out of airplanes, did parachute jumps. And
interesting.
Yeah.
Chris Hedges wrote a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He was a war journalist. And, you know, he talked about that addiction.
Yeah.
Of that. How's that going for you? Have you tempered it a little?
A little, yeah. I have three little people at home that I want to stay safe for, you know.
You don't want to go too close to the edge of the cliff.
I have a wife and a family.
Just for fun.
I just think, exactly. I'm a little bit more but temperate. There is a skateboard in the back of the car. That's about as risk-taking I get these days. Or a surfboard.
You're getting a little old for that shit, too.
I know, man. I'm a sidewalk surfer. Oh, yeah, breakable, too. But, you know, I'm not going up any ramps or jumping in the bowl.
Okay,
you know?
As long as you're not doing the pools.
No. Not these
and,
days.
And with the Marvel movies, you have peace with that? You love it?
In what sense?
I just like there seems to be on some level some Faustian agreement one makes with themselves as an actor, or else you embrace it. And I don't. What?
You got to embrace it. You got to just enjoy it. It's a celebration.
You do
it's
enjoy it,
yeah.
Because I know Brolin enjoys it.
I mean, there are certain completely, yeah. Man. You're
in, man. You're hired to do the job.
How fucking lucky are we to do this job? Period.
Right.
And
let alone
to do it with those resources, with those rewards. And often with material that's really engaging and fun and complex. And, you know, the hours are long. It's never right until the movie's kind of just about to come out. So you're constantly being called back to perfect things.
Yeah. They often
go to production without a third act. There are loads of things that are frustrating. But, you know, it's a mighty thing to play Doctor Strange in the MCU. I love it. I absolutely love it.
Oh, good. And you feel, well, you said like going into this character over and over again that, you know, you've had to sort of build him in your own way.
A little, completely. Yeah. And I wasn't a comic nerd. I didn't know much about him. I leant very heavily on Scott, who directed the first one, Scott Derrickson. And we built him from a great origin script based on the origin of the comics to a large degree. And... then he's had these sort of stepping stones in the Avengers film, but we haven't really kind of, you know, stressed him out until this one. So we'll see how he goes.
There you go. That's a responsible plug for a movie that's not even out yet. It might not be till next year sometime.
Oh, no, but I can't escape any kind of conversation about it when it comes to interviews at the moment, because it's just that well, Spider-Man is obviously on our doorstep. That's about to happen at Christmas, and Strange is a big part of that.
Yeah, so. and if you speak publicly or if you spoil Marvel movies as an actor, they
little red dots appear on you.
Yeah, they'll kill you.
Yeah, seriously. Right. Yeah. That's it.
Good talking to you, man.
Out. Nice to talk to you too, Mark.
There you go. Benedict Cumberbatch. Great films he's in right now. I don't know about the Marvel one, but I do know about The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne and The Power of the Dog. Both terrific. And now guitar again. It sounds good. I got my Stratocaster set up. Monkey and LaFonda, Cat Angels Everywhere, yeah.